And after much too long a hiatus, we're finally returning to Keith Lowe's Savage Continent, Europe in the Aftermath of World War II. We're continuing with Chapter 17, The Jewish Flight. More important than people's ignorance, however, was the sense of, and we're talking about where we left off was in watching, looking horrified at the reception that folks who'd just been through unimaginable horrors received when they got back home, quote unquote. The cold response is what we were looking at before. We're moving on to hatred. Hatred. And we needed Alice Miller to understand that. Otherwise, inexplicable reaction. More important than people's ignorance, however, the ignorance of those who responded with cruelty to returnees from the concentration camps, was the sense of discomfort that such stories, for example, of Auschwitz, inevitably provoked. According to Frank Kaiser, people in Holland reacted to his story of incarceration at Theresienstadt by saying, "I don't want to know. That's all over now. Be glad you survived." Jews who returned to other countries reported similar reactions. In France, too, according to Auschwitz survivor Alexander Kong, quote, "there was a general indifference, and Jews were urged to draw a line under their experiences." In Hungary, returning Jews were beaten if they dared to suggest that they had suffered more than their Christian neighbors. Even in America, Jewish survivors who immigrated were often treated with impatience. The war was over, enough already. One must remember that ordinary Europeans had also suffered terribly during the war, particularly in the final year. But there was at least some comfort in the thought that they had all been through it together. After the liberation, the whole continent began constructing myths of unity and adversity, and my interjection, now that we have a better understanding of the role of the media in constructing and establishing for the state what we've been calling the historical consensus, the communal voice, because we're communal beings and we need that referencing one to each other. We need to know what others are thinking. And yet we've been atomized. How does the state handle that? By providing this communal voice, a false communal voice called the media, an inauthentic voice and an inauthentic consensus. So we've been gaining a better understanding of that, as well as of the effect of internalized obedience established early on in our lives under class, in rating high success, the winners, in reinforcing power worship, as Alice Miller and Karl Popper have shown us. Questions arise in reading this, now that we have this broader understanding or deeper understanding. Questions arise in reading this about the steps involved more precisely in creating these myths, because we know how these folks work, hidden, clandestine, behind scenes. We will not see the intermediary steps from the pocketbooks to ISIS, but it exists. When you see war, you see power. They have nothing but interest in dividing us all right now, keeping us despairing. That is their number one priority. Number one priority, forestall our global awakening. If we had been talking about supporting each other, each other's confrontations with their states, would the Egyptian revolution have been devastated, destroyed, turned back, undermined? Or would it then have been able to move to a piece of the global evolution of humanity? We have to have each other's backs. And we are discussing this, I know it. whether it happens over the airwaves or not. Which means power knows it too, because they always keep their ear to the ground. So what were those intermediary steps that established these myths? And we have questions about this reaffirmed and strengthened nationalist sentiment. Reestablished, I suspect, on the comfortable for the state ground of lack of tolerance for dissent in regard to it. Continuing, these myths suited pretty much everybody, from former collaborators who wanted a chance to be brought back into the fold, to an exhausted public that was eager to put the war behind them, and to the politicians who wanted to rebuild a sense of national pride. Even at an international level, the idea that all the different peoples of Europe had suffered together under Nazism was a convenient way to rebuild a common sense of brotherhood between battered nations and to get the new consensus rolling again, the new consensus under power's terms. But the presence of the Jews made a mockery of such myths. Not only had they suffered much, much more than everyone else, but none of the other groups had come to their aid. The comfortable thought that Europeans had been all in it together was demonstrably untrue. My interjection, the uncomfortable thought that the state in us is the ultimate root of the success of state manipulation of us, is critical for us to begin to discuss. Continuing. Here, perhaps, is the key to why the plight of returning Jews was so commonly ignored in the aftermath of the war, not only in Holland, but all over Western Europe. While stories of resistance gave people the chance to feel good about themselves and reassure themselves that they too had produced their fair share of heroes, the stories of the Jews had the opposite effect. They were a reminder of former failings at every level of society. Their very presence was enough to create discomfort, as though they might at any moment reveal an embarrassing secret. It was far easier, therefore, simply to pretend that what had befallen the Jews was really just the same as what had happened to everyone else. Far from being welcomed, they were ignored, sidelined, silenced.